Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Israel's 36th government, the Bennett-Lapid government, was sworn in a little over a week ago. Since then, it has attacked Hamas positions in the Gaza Strip, brought an end to one of the more grievous IDF policies in the West Bank, and had an offer of 1 million COVID vaccinations rejected by the Palestinian Authority. Joining us today to discuss the security challenges facing the new government, between the West Bank and Washington, between Tehran and Gaza, I'm delighted to welcome back Haaretz's military analyst, Amos Harel. Thank you for joining us, Amos.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Amos, Naftali Bennett opened his first cabinet meeting as prime minister on Sunday with a scathing attack on newly elected Iranian president Ibrahim Raisi, whom he called the hangman of Tehran, the man infamous among Iranians for death committees that executed thousands of innocent citizens. Netanyahu may no longer be in office, but the rhetoric on Iran remains the same, right?
More or less so. I think everything Bennett has said is actually accurate. There will be probably an attempt made in Europe and maybe even in the United States to normalize Raisi, the new president. But Bennett is right about his legacy. This guy was an executioner. The hangman from Tehran is, as far as we can tell, quite an accurate name. And Bennett is speaking the truth about this. I think it was to be expected that Bennett would take the same kind of position, at least publicly and officially, that Netanyahu had regarding Iran. But I think what's perhaps more important is what's going on behind the scenes. Israeli Army's Chief of Staff, General Kochavi, is spending this week in Washington for a visit that was canceled a few times over the situation in Gaza. He will discuss with the Pentagon and with the National Security Council the Iranian clear threat. And for the first time, Kochavi is able to talk to the Americans about what Israel expects from the new nuclear agreement. And this is very different than the orders which the chiefs of Mossad and the military intelligence and the head of the Israeli NSC received from Netanyahu just a month ago when they visited DC. So there's quite a difference, and I think it's more, perhaps more important than what Bennett says publicly, the fact that Bennett is giving Kochavi enough rope to discuss with the Americans, allowing him to bring up Israeli reservations about the future agreement. That's very, very different than the Netanyahu position, which was everything you want to do is bad, and we're not discussing this. We're just warning you about the consequences.
So what has changed in the Israeli message?
I think it's more than anything else, it's about the personas. Netanyahu was heavily invested in the Iranian nuclear threat. That was ideologically and strategically his number one priority for years and years. It was the whole justification for him staying in power. He constantly talked about the danger of a second Holocaust to the Jewish people, and he effectively saw himself as the only leader who can prevent that by fighting Iran to the end. Bennett is much less invested ideologically and emotionally in this issue. He recognizes the severity of the threat, the importance of a tough Israeli strategy towards Iran, but he can allow himself more room for maneuvering because he isn't identified with the problem so much. And I think in retrospect, it's quite clear now that there's a huge gap between Netanyahu's public rhetoric over the issue and between what he actually achieved. It's quite clear that because of the Israeli pressure on President Trump to drop out of the agreement 3 years ago, the end result is that actually Iran is much closer to producing a first nuclear bomb than it was pre the American withdrawal from the agreement 3 years ago. And this is, again, historically, when we will judge this period in 10 or 15 years, this will be one of the major points brought against Netanyahu. And Bennett looks at this differently. He's much more, I wouldn't say he's casual about this, but he's realistic and pragmatic about this. He will try his best to influence the Americans, but he knows that he's off to a bad start to begin with because of the relationship between Biden and Netanyahu, and because of all the time lost since Trump decided to leave the JCPOA, the agreement with Iran.
Mm. Is it possible that without the personal antagonism towards Netanyahu over his aggressive efforts to scupper the deal over the years, that Israel is now actually in a better place to tweak the next deal?
I would say that this is true. I suspect that it may be a bit too late because the Americans are going full steam ahead. It's quite clear that they're intending to reach the final agreement before Raisi is actually sworn in as president. If I'm not mistaken, that's in about 6 weeks, about the beginning of August. So I'm not sure there's enough time left. I published a story last Friday about three senior officials from different branches of the Israeli security establishment who warned the government that there's a very narrow window of opportunity and that Israel needs to act now to talk both to the Europeans and to the Americans about this and to try influence as much as we can the final agreement with Iran. Netanyahu, of course, wouldn't listen to such demands or such recommendations. Bennett is much more open to that. He received the document, the letter they sent. And actually, as far as we can tell, Kochavi did get enough leverage and enough room for discussions with the Americans. We'll see if it does any good, but at least he has the power to discuss this, something that was absolutely forbidden under Netanyahu.
And it's the Israeli military that is spearheading the contacts, right? This isn't a foreign ministry or PMO mission?
It's mostly about the military. Because Kochavi canceled his own visit, which was about to be part of this delegation, I think it was late April, he canceled it at that time because things were beginning to escalate in Gaza. Now he's in Washington on his own, but I would assume that other officials would arrive there quite soon and that there will be discussions. It remains to be seen whether there's an actual Israeli influence over the outcome of the agreement, but at least there's an attempt now to influence what the Americans and the Europeans are ready to discuss with the Iranians.
And as we said, they might be more receptive with this message not coming via Netanyahu anymore.
Yes, that's quite clear. I mean, in spite of what Biden and Netanyahu kept saying about this so-called 40 years of friendship between the two and so on, it was quite evident that the most officials around Biden could not forgive Netanyahu for his treatment of Obama when the discussions were held between the two countries regarding the original JCPOA in 2015. There was a lot of emotional baggage from that period. Mm. And even Biden himself, although he was quite polite to Netanyahu, he didn't make any efforts to invite him to the White House during the few months he was in power. He didn't make an effort to call Netanyahu. I think it took about 6 weeks until there was a final phone call between the two of them. Now look at the difference. Last Sunday, immediately after Bennett's government was sworn in, I think that the first world leader to actually personally call him and congratulate him was Biden. So I think Biden is sending quite a clear message to Jerusalem, and this message is meant both for Bennett and for his predecessor, Netanyahu. Mm.
Just before we started recording, Amos, Raisi made his first public comments since being elected. Obviously, he urged the United States to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal and to lift all sanctions on Iran. He also insisted that his country's ballistic missile program is not negotiable. How at all will his election affect Israel?
I'm not sure it will affect, at least in the short run. He's a hardliner, it's quite clear. Iran, in spite of the hardliner being elected and in spite of the leadership of the spiritual leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is in fact willing to negotiate with the West and possibly reach a new agreement over its nuclear project. It's Khamenei calling the shots when things like the nuclear project are discussed. And therefore, I see maybe more of a hardliner than Rouhani, the current president. But I'm not sure it will affect Israel in any major way. The animosity is there to begin with. Regarding his statement about the ballistic plan, this is the official position of the Iranian Republic. They're not willing to discuss anything about the ballistic plan or about Iranian involvement supporting guerrilla and terrorist organizations all over the Middle East. I think the Americans have already given up on this idea to begin with. The question is whether, in the long run, the U.S. would return to that and make demands from the Iranians regarding these other questions. But I don't think this will be included in the second version of the JCPOA.
Mm. Iran isn't the only cloud on the horizon of Israel-US relations, right? You wrote an analysis explaining how China could become an issue in bilateral relations, presumably not because of TikTok this time.
Yeah, China is already an issue for quite some time. I think it's Israel that fails to understand the full scope and severity of this debate from an American perspective. It's quite clear to anybody who's been following events in Washington in the last few years that both the Republican and Democratic administrations feel that Chinese influence is the most important strategic threat that the U.S. is facing. Mm. And what they're saying quite clearly to all of their allies is take a step back. We know that there are huge economic spoils for anybody going to bed, so to speak, with the Chinese, but you need to choose your to pick sides. You need to show where your alliance is, and that's quite clear that Israel depends on America much more than it does on any other country. Netanyahu tried somehow to walk through this by, on the one hand, sending signals to the Chinese that everything is open to discussions, trade deals, and so on, and on the other hand, promising the Americans that nothing of importance would be transferred from Israel to China, that the Chinese would not learn any important technological or military secrets from Israel, and that Israel would refrain from any kind of deals which have to do with issues that the Americans perceive as dangerous. More than anything else, it's about 5G infrastructure for cell phones and the like. Mm. I'm not sure that the Americans would be satisfied by this. We've seen growing American pressure on Israel to withdraw from all kinds of deals with the Chinese, with different Chinese companies who are heavily connected, of course, to the regime. In recent years, and I think we'll see more and more of that in the next year or two because of the way Washington perceives this. We'll have to see how much aware Bennett is of this, and is he willing to walk this tight rope the way Netanyahu did. There was growing frustration in Washington. I kept hearing it from American sources in the last two or three years over Netanyahu's conduct on this issue.
Mm. Amos, let's move on to Gaza, shall we? The new government was sworn in exactly 8 days ago. Which I think that makes today its Brit Milah, possibly, maybe not.
Yeah.
It barely got 100 hours of grace before it faced its first test on the Gaza front. How did it perform?
Not very differently from the previous government, I think. Again, it's a case of hardliner Israeli rhetoric, which is usually not backed up with too much action. The problem for Bennett, there were two challenges there. One was the fact that Netanyahu left a sort of an explosive issue to be dealt with, this celebration in Jerusalem by the extreme right-wingers. And there were threats from Hamas that it would act to defend Al-Aqsa, so to speak, and so on. And secondly, there's still the residue, the outcome of the last Israeli military operation in Gaza, which ended close to the end of May. The fact is that things have not gotten back to, it's hard to speak of normalcy in Gaza, but things are not normal in any way right now. Israel is not allowing the Palestinians to move freely, and not even to export or import much stuff through the border passages. Israel is doing this because it's trying to dictate a new equation regarding Gaza, meaning that Hamas needs to maintain absolute calm in order to receive more support for its infrastructure. It's also trying to change the rules regarding the Qatari money. You know that it comes in suitcases with an envoy, $30 million, mostly in cash, every month. Israel is trying to change that. It wants more international control. It wants the Palestinian Authority to be involved in order to make sure that much of this money is not used by Hamas for its military ends. And this is, of course, hard to do. And since Hamas is not willing to accept this attempt by Israel to dictate new rules, there were all kinds of incidents using balloons, trying to start fires in Israeli fields along the border and so on. Now, looking at this from listening to what's going on here from the UK or the US, this all may sound quite strange. Why is Israel insisting so much to deal with a question that has to do with what, with a few fires because of some balloons being sent or some kites being sent and so on? On the other hand, domestically and politically, this is a very important issue for any government, and especially for Bennett, who is a right-winger, who used to attack Netanyahu from the right to criticize him for not being tough enough on Gaza. So Bennett needs to show some strength, and this is why he decided twice to order the Israeli Air Force to strike with fighter planes. So some Hamas military compounds were hit twice during the last week. On the other hand, the fact that nobody was hurt during those strikes means that he's still walking the same line cautiously, trying to avoid a full-scale escalation. As far as we can tell, Hamas itself, or at least Hamas military wing, is not interested in a major escalation as well. But things could go wrong quite quickly. We've seen that happen last year, this year as well. This could go wrong, and this could become the new government's first challenge.
So far, Bennett has managed to avoid promising to topple the Hamas regime, which seems to be something that every incoming prime minister or defense minister or whatever does. He did say on Sunday, though, that Hamas will have to get used to a different Israeli approach, one of initiative, decisiveness, and suspicion. What is that different approach? It doesn't sound like anything is different.
This is the same equation I just mentioned, Simon. This is about Israeli demands of a full calm returning to the Gaza Strip, no incidents whatsoever on the one hand. He's also, I think, hinting to the POW problems. As you know, there are two Israeli citizens who are held live by Hamas, who kidnapped, crossed the border to Gaza for their own personal reasons, but were kidnapped more or less and kept by Hamas. And there are also two bodies of Israeli soldiers that Hamas holds in Gaza since the war in 2014. So he's trying to solve this as well. Thankfully, he didn't use a very strong rhetoric, and he didn't, as you said, he didn't threaten to topple the Hamas regime. I think, you know, he's older than that now. He's more of an adult when these issues are discussed. He knows how Israel failed miserably to reach its goals in Gaza in the past. And he also knows that most of the Israeli public, although it usually tends to be tough on issues like fighting terror, has no illusions over Gaza anymore. What I found very interesting about the last round of violence last month was that even the right wing in Israel did not demand a ground incursion into Gaza this time. The public was all for more strikes and fighting Hamas aggressively and so on, but there was no support and no demand to send the boys in, to send the ground forces inside Gaza. And this is, I think, this shows perhaps that the public has grown up about Gaza. I think that most Israelis understand that there are no simple solutions, and that it's not only about using military power in order to solve things. And as I said, even the right-wingers, people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and so on, even those groups and those politicians are not saying, okay, let's send divisions, tank divisions and infantry brigades inside Gaza and change everything there, because everybody's aware of the fact that A, this is very unpopular, and B, that this would be very, very costly when you talk of military casualties.
Mm. So also in the first few days of this new government, Amos, the IDF announced that it would stop conducting intelligence collecting raids on Palestinian homes in the West Bank, a practice that's been heavily criticized by human rights groups. What were those raids?
Look, I don't think that this has any major significance, strategically speaking, and I don't think it has to do with the current government. This is a conduct that was used for years. We wrote about that a few times in the past. For many, many years, the IDF conducted this sort of raids, which were called mipui in Hebrew, mapping, meaning that you visited a home, usually at night, frightened the family and so on, and collected details about the house, took photographs, checked who actually lived there and so on. And supposedly this was to gather more intelligence in order for the IDF to act more accurately if there was an escalation in the West Bank. Now, in the end, this was, they realized that this was unnecessary, that it meant more and more unnecessary friction and suffering for the Palestinian side, and that most of this information could be gathered elsewhere by technological means and so on. As usual, this is not something that the IDF has concluded by itself. It's the Supreme Court that forced them to reach such a conclusion. I think it's important for the Palestinians. It's important that Israeli soldiers are not sent to this kind of senseless mission anymore. But it doesn't say a lot neither about the government or the situation at large.
It was a decision that was in the pipeline before
this
government.
Yeah, it was made by the Supreme Court, and it forced the IDF to look at the situation and actually take the necessary steps, but it's not something that happened top down in any kind of way. It's not the government, neither the previous one or the current one, had nothing to do with that.
So Amos, let's wrap things up with the vaccine story, the details or the interpretation of which are hotly contested. What we know is that towards the end of last week, Israel offered the Palestinian 1.2 million doses of COVID vaccines, which the PA rejected, saying that they were too close to their expiration date. Was this a good faith offer by Israel or an exercise in point scoring?
I think it was more of a good faith offer. I think this time it has to do with the current government, with the new one. Nitzan Horowitz from Meretz is the new Minister of Health. And I think that this government could afford itself to be more pragmatic about this issue. It was quite clear for months that this was the right thing to do, not only morally, but instrumentally. Israel is more or less, until the rise of the last Delta variant from India a few days ago, Israel was close, probably closer than any other country in the world, to reach herd immunity. And things got back to normal here, as you know, during the last month. The problem remained the situation in the West Bank. It's not only a moral obligation, but for both the West Bank and in some sense to Gaza as well, but it's also an instrumental issue. If you don't block COVID from spreading in the West Bank, in the end, it would reach Israel again through Palestinians who work in Israel, through family ties between Arab residents of Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank, and so on. So it was the right thing to do for quite some time. But Netanyahu avoided this for emotional reasons, for political reasons, and on top of everything else, he was also willing a few months ago to send vaccines to different countries, whether it was Latin America or Eastern Europe, in return for all kinds of diplomatic favors. And then at one time, the Attorney General intervened and stopped Netanyahu from doing that. But the issue with the Palestinians was never solved. So the new government adopted the recommendations of the medical experts, who the people from the Ministry of Health who were saying for months now that this had to be done. The problem, as usual in Israel, is that things were not organized very well. And as you said, many of these vaccine doses were actually close to their expiration dates. On the other hand, the Palestinians had their own contribution to this miserable affair by refusing to accept them. And now there's a strange story, I'm not sure how accurate this is, but actually that some of these vaccine doses were kept in Ramallah while others were returned. And then there's a suspicion that people who are closer to the PA leadership will get their hands on the vaccines, while others will have to wait because the PA is sending a political message here by returning the doses. I hope that this would get solved soon. I think there's, for the first time, there's a real good intention from the Israeli side. It, as usual, it was done in the wrong way. It should have been done a lot better and earlier. But I think there's a possibility here to provide more vaccines to the Palestinian side, which is something that there's both a moral obligation, in my view, for Israel, but also it could be good for the region and could help us prevent COVID from spreading again.
So another case of the new government stepping in to clean up the mess of the previous one?
In a way, yes. Again, like Iran. The verdict isn't out yet about the new government. We'll have to see if, in fact, it's an improvement. But there are some positive signs, mostly about the everyday conduct, which is very, very different from Netanyahu's last days.
Amos, I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week. Many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listener, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Many thanks to Amos Harel and, of course, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. And before I sign off, a reminder that Gidon Levy is standing by to answer your questions on the next episode of Haaretz Weekend, which will be landing in your podcast app of choice on Friday. The email address for sending questions appears in the program notes of this episode. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.